I'm John O'Loughlin. Welcome to McDuff Lives Podcast. It's just rare that you find a book that just says, this is the path that we need to follow, is to read this book, understand this book, pick it apart, follow the footnotes, do whatever you need to do, because this is the path to saving our country and saving our health. Hello, everyone. I'm John O'Loughlin. Welcome to McDuff Lives. Glad to have you with me as we continue our readings from The Sleeper Agent by A.W. Finnegan. The Rise of Lyme Disease, Chronic Illness, and the Great Imitator Antigens of Biological Warfare. And I'm trying to be as positive as I can as I read through this very difficult material. It's shocking, it's frightening in some ways, and it's depressing. In fact, I found myself yesterday feeling kind of depressed because of the plethora of problems that have come along with the Lyme disease, but also excited because as long as we can find out where it came from, we have some hope of defeating it. And although it's complex and difficult to diagnose and consists of many different diseases in most cases, this thing we call Lyme disease is growing in this country. The statistics show it. And statistics also show that when you have Lyme disease, you often have something else that comes along with it. And that, of course, supports what I've been realizing and accepting from the work of A.W. Finnegan in his book, The Sleeper Agent, and that is that this has been concocted by biological warfare experts, at the pinnacle of which was Eric Traub, who was with the Rockefeller Institute, with Germany, with Nazi Germany, with the Soviet Union, with the United States, and with Great Britain in different periods of time, but in such a way that he could influence and cause this disease to be the sleeper agent. The sleeper agent that while you might get sick for a little while and then it goes away, but it never really goes away, it's there and it can come back. Immune tolerance created artificially by biological manipulation by bioweaponeers such as Eric Traub. So we've learned a lot, or at least encountered a lot of scientific terms such as Borrelia anserina or Borrelia gallica, then Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the specific bacterium that is causing Lyme disease according to the isolation of that particular pathogen by Burgdorfer, but the fact that it existed before then and the fact that its weaponization occurred long before Burgdorfer got involved in the investigation indicates that, no, he did not create it. He did not invent it. It was, in fact, a weaponized pathogen created by Eric Traub. So trying to summarize where we're at is difficult. We've covered an awful lot of ground. The last reading was difficult for me because of so much of the scientific lingo, but the idea is that there are multiple other pathogens that have been packed into these weaponized ticks along with the Borrelia burgdorferi. And we also had to learn, which I never knew the word spirochetes before, but this is apparently part of the pathogen that creates the infectiousness. Well, don't learn it from me, learn it from Adam Finnegan as we continue reading. We're in chapter 14. We've read a couple pages of it on Monday, and now we are on page 235. The caption is Public Relations and Socio-Political Offensives. This paragraph that we started is about Kathleen Dixon, a whistleblower, and how she was attacked by Edward McSweegan to try to discredit her activism. And in response to a letter, we have this response. I'll just read this introductory paragraph. According to an interview I did of Kathleen Dixon in 2018, he went after her following her testimony to the FDA and had her arrested on trumped-up charges, of which she was later cleared. He spent most of his time antagonizing Lyme victims on the internet and setting up propaganda campaigns with people such as Susan O'Connell, a British counterpart, and ruthlessly went after people like Ms. Dixon for her testimony to the FDA. In a later correspondence obtained through FOIA, McSweagan can be seen discussing the extent of these campaigns much later in 2007, with numerous mainstream outlets and internet channels to keep the cover-up in place. And this is a letter from McSweagan to O'Connell. Dr. O'Connell, thank you for your note. I sent a copy of it to Dr. Steve Barrett, who built and manages the QuackWatch website. I have urged him to consider updating the section on Lyme disease, but I believe he has been somewhat distracted by other matters in recent years. Still, it may be possible to update the Lyme material by copying it to another site with HTML links back to the QuackWatch index page. I'm looking into this possibility. I've already drafted some updated material, just in case, if you and your colleagues would like to suggest needed changes, new data, and references, please send them to me. If outer space is the military's ultimate high ground, then cyberspace is the high ground in an information war. And what we have here is a war, actually, a disinformation war, an insurgency against evidence-based medicine. It's time to start shooting back. I'm vaguely familiar with your informal group to counteract misinformation. Derland Fish mentioned it to me. Sounds like a good start. Certainly, we have to do a better job of quickly responding to the accusations and antics of activists. We also have to do a better job of educating members of Congress and, in your case, Parliament. And we have to do a better job of keeping in touch with science and medical writers in the press and providing them with the necessary facts, references, quotes, and sound bites. Personally, I had been thinking that it might be useful to have a limited access website containing material to facilitate quick responses to reporters' questions and to facilitate the drafting of letters to legislators and editors. Such an online repository might contain copies of published articles on treatment trials and appropriate diagnostic methods, published commentaries on chronic Lyme disease, previously published letters to the editor, and examples of letters to send to local and national legislators. I suspect many physicians and scientists would like nothing more than to dash off a response to a newspaper or a congressman, but lack the time to look up the references, dig out the quotes, and hone their message down to 300 or 400 words. This kind of repository would help. I already have my own little repository, which I rely on for drafting letters to the editor, parentheses of Nature, Epi and Inf, I guess. Epi and Inf must be an abbreviation of a publication. The Hartford Courant, the Washington Post, and others, close parentheses. Letters to congressmen, parentheses Phil Baker and I both responded to a December 2006 ILADS-inspired congressional letter to the CDC, close parentheses. Book reviews and columns I write for a local Maryland paper. It's a lot easier to load and shoot if the ammunition is handy. Anyway, it's one idea. Another idea would be to start a visible organization of researchers and ID docs with clearly stated goals and concerns similar to SEA, Scientists and Engineers for America. And it gives a website of www.seform.org. It could provide a convenient focal point for communication and strategy. Whatever course we choose, it's going to be a long struggle. The Lymeese and their parasitic LLMDs have been at this for a long time, unquote. LLMDs means Lyme literate MDs, discussed in the last chapter. McSweagan had just provided evidence for the reader that mainstream news outlets and online debunking sites like QuackWatch are helping to push the corporate science and public health agency talking points by American and British public health officials through the Ad Hoc International Lyme Disease Study Group, a working group with participation by other foreign governments such as Susan O'Connell of Porton Down Laboratories in Britain. Oh boy, Porton Down. Just prior to that exchange, declassified records show McSweegan can be seen again in an email correspondence of a similar nature, this time with the ALDF president, Phil Baker. Academic professors such as Derland Fish, Alan Steer, and Henry Feder, with Barbara Johnson and Gary Wormser also on the email. The email was prompted by a posting of a $20,000 reward to any doctor who can prove that a patient did not still have Lyme disease following treatment with antibiotics. And this was posted by a Lyme activist, Randy Sykes, in Connecticut, where a conference being attended by corporate and academic professionals was to take place. The exchange begins with Derland Fish citing a lack of scientific means to counter the growing discontent and fraudulent guidelines. Quote, the battle cannot be won on a scientific front. We need to mount a social political offensive. But we are outnumbered and outgunned. We need reinforcements from outside our field. Edward McSweegan replied, quote, for sick people, they certainly have a lot of energy, not to mention a lot of signs and placards. Alan Steer then returned with some recommendations. Ed, I've been meaning to write to you about the UCS letter and have not had a chance to do so. There is one point that I would like to emphasize. In untreated patients, there is a chronic form of Lyme disease that commonly results in Lyme arthritis, or in rare cases, Lyme encephalopathy or polyneuropathy. Our point is that subjective pain, neurocognitive or fatigue symptoms following IDSA-recommended courses of antibiotic therapy for Lyme disease are not caused by active infection. Moreover, there is no peer-reviewed medical evidence that shows that months or years of antibiotic therapy is beneficial for the treatment of such symptoms. However, I think we need to be careful not to say there is no chronic form of Lyme disease. Such language has been largely removed from current draft of the letter. However, I have made a few suggestions for care in these statements. I would be willing to sign the letter as long as a number of other members of the Ad Hoc International Lyme Disease Study Group do so. Thanks for taking on this important task, Alan. The study group referred to in the aforementioned email correspondence was an official international working group on Lyme disease, publishing a series of papers since the very beginning to establish Lyme disease as a limited infection producing an autoimmune arthritis, curable with a few weeks of antibiotics, except for what they considered a very small minority that experienced ongoing symptoms after treatment. Their message would imply that there was nothing further that could be done aside from autoimmune management, which these biotech and drug firms would market and profit from. Those involved in such groups would publish several papers every few years to paint for the public a misleading picture, saying that chronic Lyme disease was not a persistent Borrelia burgdorferi infection or an immunosuppressive disease, and that post-treatment symptoms were a very rare autoimmune problem due to the initial Borrelia burgdorferi infection. That unless patients had antibodies to meet bogus criteria for infection or autoimmune, they were psychiatric cases, as an early go at these socio-political offensives claimed. Quote, neurologic symptoms, especially those involving changes in cognitive functions, are especially difficult to interpret. Moreover, factors such as the premorbid personality and a tendency to somatization may determine the length of convalescence and the response to post-infection fatigue and joint aches. Unquote. Evidence-debased medicine is the caption. The science of immune tolerance as a disabling disease producing little to no antibodies nor detectable inflammation was proven by the pioneer of German virology, Erich Traub, beginning in 1936. However, around the time of the emergence of Lyme disease and about 15 years before it was officially considered a disease, the infectious origins of immune tolerance were being wiped from public knowledge, with a Nobel Prize given in 1960 to Burnett and Medawar for immune tolerance, but only in organ transplant recipients. And they would ignore all the cases infected with stealth pathogens. This was being done not just with Lyme disease, but all the stealth infections that caused immunosuppression and produced chronic persistent infections. Since these complex diseases are costly and hard to address, the medical scientific establishment would rather not have the headache of addressing them, not having to explain how it could be possible that an infection can occur and be spread without antibodies or outward symptoms. Because the science of vaccination is supposed to assume that lack of symptoms means lack of infection, and that lack of symptoms correlates to lack of ability to spread. And immune tolerance flips that entire paradigm on its head, as Traub's published research demonstrates. Therefore, to make it more convenient for the prestige of health professionals and the profiteering of Big Pharma, they set up the current public health paradigm so that the only evidence admissible in diagnosis is a standard whereby all definable and reportable diseases are only those which produce robust antibody responses and detectable inflammation. Traub's weapons do the reverse. These immunosuppressive biological weapons demonstrate that half of a disease spectrum is marked by chronic infection and defective immune response, and the only standard used in the current paradigm of the Western public health system to detect a disease is to measure antibodies and visible inflammation. This is entirely insufficient, and this is the reason why millions are being swept under the rug and denied care for their disease. Because the disease itself is being denied as illegitimate. Evidence-based medicine tells us that if cases of chronic disease and immune tolerance wish to be considered sick, they would have to demonstrate evidence of a robust immune system, lots of antibodies, and inflammation, or it lacks an evidence-based, quote-unquote, approach. Evidence-based medicine is a term denoting the patient having to use the wrong tests to prove a disease it was meant to evade. It would be comparable to giving somebody exposed to asbestos a test for measuring toxic lead exposures and telling them to prove they had asbestos exposure using that test. Chapter 15, The Legacy of a Sleeper Agent. Eric Traub, Pioneer of Immune Tolerance and the Slow Virus Disease. Here's a quote from a book called The Black Swan by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. The answer is that there are two varieties of rare events. A, the narrated black swans, those that are present in the current discourse and that you are likely to hear about on television, and B, those nobody talks about since they escape models. When Eric Traub returned to Germany in 1953 to lead the Federal Research Institute for Virus Diseases of Animals in Tübingen, West Germany, records from his earlier FBI investigation and his published scientific research demonstrate that upon his return to Germany, he continued collaborating and associating with the Americans for years to come. In fact, even when Traub was forced to step down as president of the Tübingen Institute for Embezzlement and other charges, he was still held in the highest regard by the Americans and kept a prominent position with the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, of the United Nations. Despite confessing to being an agent of the KGB, which under normal circumstances would have been a death sentence, Traub was allowed to continue limited collaborative research for the U.S. Navy and the USDA. And on numerous occasions, the Americans sent Traub dangerous pathogens, viruses like Eastern Equine Encephalomyelitis Virus, that's EEE, Venezuelan Equine Encephalomyelitis Virus, VEE, Lymphocytic Chorioméningitis Virus, that's LCM, Newcastle Disease Virus, NDV, and Vesicular Stomatitis Virus, VSV. Traub was then approved for several trips to re-enter the United States to take part in symposiums and conferences in the field of virology and agriculture and to be a guest of honor at Plum Island's opening day ceremony in 1956. According to the travel logbook used by the Tübingen Institute in the spring of 1953, Traub and several colleagues from the Institute took a trip to Basel, Switzerland to visit a Swiss veterinary institute. In June of that year, Werner Schaefer and his colleague Otto Armbruster, who were working with Traub from the Max Planck Institute at the time, took a trip for Traub to Berlin, East Germany, to visit the Siemens and Halske Company, the company in charge of the electron microscope department at Insel Reims and the University of Berlin. The following month, Traub traveled to Rome and to Austria for the FAO to attend a conference on foot and mouth disease. Continuing research in Tübingen. Some of Traub's American research for the U.S. Navy continued at the Tübingen Institute, demonstrating that UV radiation acts as an accelerant to Newcastle disease virus when the virus is not fully inactivated by heavy doses of radiation. As UV radiation is often used to inactivate viruses in vaccine research, Traub showed that if the virus was not fully inactivated, it would have a rebound effect and greatly strengthen the virus, multiplying rapidly to quickly regain itself as a more powerful virus. This paper was published in 1954, concluding his Navy research once and for all. Already in 1954, Traub produced a research paper in the French language for the FAO and its associated journal, the Bulletin of the International Office of Epizootics, on FMD being able to survive and spread on vegetable products used in farming. In 1955, one of the first papers published by Traub as president of the Tübingen Institute, he took to studying the immune tolerance phenomenon transmitted from the mother chicken to her chicks through the chicken eggs. It is noted in this paper that Wallace P. Rowe, a former colleague of Traub at the Naval Medical Research Institute and the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, sent Traub strains of LCM virus for these experiments. The same year, the USDA sent Traub a virulent strain of Eastern equine encephalitis virus for studies on the thermoresistance of EEE. And he was also sent a strain of Venezuelan equine encephalitis virus for additional experiments in Tübingen. Traub published another interesting work that year, quote, effects of salvarsan on influenza infection of chick embryos, unquote, with researcher Eva Rezko. Interestingly, salvarsan was a treatment of choice for syphilis and spirochetal infections like relapsing fever prior to doxycycline. Traub knew the main component of his strategic bioweapons like Lyme spirochetes were the persistent viral infections reawakened from dormancy after the onset of infection with Lyme disease and the devious cocktail of tick-borne disease it often came with. These infections awakened sleeping viruses already harbored in the host and act like the foreign protein that awakened LCM virus in Traub's Rockefeller mice. In this paper, Traub was not interested in the effect of salvarsan on spirochetes, but instead, he wanted to know the effect of salvarsan on viral infections and proceeded to study it with influenza as a model. What Traub found was that administration of an intensive course of treatment with salvarsan, that's S-A-L-V-A-R-S-A-N, would actually greatly accelerate the viral infection. And in a quote, the following is about the effect. Salvarsan sodium, which accelerates the infection in large but still tolerated doses and inhibits it in small doses under certain circumstances, unquote. In early 1956, Traub published a research paper on the possibilities of transmission of EEE by contact between infected and uninfected mice. In this paper, he describes migratory birds and insects playing a primary role for the disease. In the experiments, he notes the use of mites and lice on the mice, and also describes injecting infected mouse excrement and urine into the brains of the test mice. He next mentions cannibalism in the mouse colony, whereby the uninfected would become infected after consuming the brains of other mice, which resembled diseases like the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, TSC, like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, CJD, also called Kuru, seen in humans and animals after cannibalism. Clearly, the nature of these experiments speak to the sadistic mindset and cruelty to animals like that described in his FBI investigations by former Rockefeller staff. In September of 1956, Traub once again set foot on American shores to attend Plum Island's opening day ceremony, where the USDA hosted a conference on vesicular diseases. Several years later, in 1958, Traub filled out a security application to the FBI to receive special permission to enter the United States once again, presumably to attend the symposium which he took part of that year, Perspectives of Virology. In February of 1958, and in the application to the FBI, he listed employment with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA, employed at the Greenport Long Island Station, which is the Plum Island Laboratory. He cites Public Law 490, the 80th Congress, as the authority for appointment, which is the 1948 legislation and congressional hearing to establish a foot and mouth disease virus laboratory on an isolated island, which eventually settled on Plum Island. Back at the Tubingen Institute, Traub hired a former war criminal, Eugen Hagen, a prominent German virologist and bacteriologist who worked at the Robert Koch Institute and the University of Strasbourg. Like Traub, Hagen attended the Rockefeller Institute before World War II, became a member of the air raid protection for the German Reich. Hagen researched viruses like influenza and epidemic jaundice, typhus, and took part in Nazi experiments on concentration camp inmates. During the war, Hagen coordinated with close contacts that Traub would also work with, such as Kurt Herzberg, professor at the University of Greifswald, who also worked with Ensel Reims during the war. And like Traub, Hagen was also recruited to work for the Soviet Union, but was arrested by British military police and extradited to France for war crimes. For Hagen's part in war crimes, he was initially sentenced to 20 years hard labor in France, but for reasons unclear, his sentence was commuted to several years, given amnesty in 1955, and he was free by the time Traub became president of the Tubingen Institute. Traub then hired Hagen, who worked at Traub's Institute from 1956 to 1965. How the Mighty Have Fallen: Major Scandal and Resignation. By 1958, mounting tensions and instability at the Tubingen Institute initiated federal investigations after the dismissal of several Institute employees who wrote formal complaints to the administrative authorities of the Federal Minister for Food, Agriculture, and Forestry with pleas for investigation of misconduct, misdirection of federal money, fictitious travel expenses, and criminal actions on behalf of Traub's leadership of the Tubingen Institute. The majority of complaints were directed toward Vice President Hans Melz, including sexual misconduct, but voiced Traub's complicity in the misdirection of federal money, among other things. According to the investigation, Melz had sexually assaulted some of the female staff at the Institute, including Ms. Thea Hahn, an employee of the Institute. Vice President Melz was alleged to have inappropriately groped and approached numerous female employees at company outings in the years prior while inebriated, as was often the case. Melz had been cited throughout the long investigations as being an alcoholic and a womanizer. The incident involving Ms. Thea Hahn was reported to local police in Tubingen and Stuttgart, supported by co-workers. Fearing they were soon to be fired, employees Otto Weiss and Emil Geis followed with allegations to the authorities above the Institute, alleging serious mismanagement, fraud, and embezzlement were taking place. Simultaneously, reports of fictitious travel outings and fraudulent receipts to cover a complex web of financial inconsistencies were being brought up and looked at. Smaller allegations opened the door to much larger ones. Traub was being looked at in further detail because of the recklessness of Melz, while Traub could be described as a smooth criminal. However, the careless and often inebriated Vice President Melz ensured that many years of mismanagement at the Institute would soon be crashing down on both of them. Back in America the same year, Dr. Jacob Traum retired as lead scientist for the USDA's Plum Island Animal Disease Center, and the USDA once again offered Eric Traub the top position to lead Plum Island. This came several months after the federal government of West Germany began its embezzlement investigations against Traub and Melz. Apparently, the USDA did not get that memo, and perhaps someone didn't fill them in on his espionage confession to Agent Dan Benjamin in 1952 either. At any rate, Traub once again declined the USDA's offer. Ironically, however, the following year, Traub decried his return to Germany in a letter to the Federal Minister for Food, Agriculture, and Forestry in May 1959. Quote, "In 1952, I was working in America under very favorable conditions. The Federal Minister for Food, Agriculture, and Forestry in Bonn invited me to come back to Germany in 1952 to set up and manage a large virus institute there, especially for foot and mouth disease. Although the Federal Republic of Germany could only offer me a fraction of the income that I received in America, Out of pure idealism as a German, I accepted and took over the construction of the Institute. For this purpose, I returned to Germany in 1953. In December of 1959, during one of the proceedings against Traub and Melz, Traub was again quoted complaining about having left his position in America. Traub described the structure of the Federal Research Institute. He pointed out that the separation in the institution between the epidemic section and the administration had been a great disadvantage for the control of the same. Quote, if I had known that the construction would take 7 years, I would not have come back from the United States, unquote. Charges were eventually brought against both Melz and Traub, with Melz taking the bulk of responsibility and Traub coming out of it with heavy fines, a criminal record, and a semi-tarnished reputation in Germany. Most interestingly, some of the activities of Vice President Melz speak to a high life of nightclubs, heavy drinking, strippers, prostitutes, and excessive alcohol consumption. And this is a quote from the record. Melz then reported an incident that is said to have taken place in 1957. After a night of drinking with Lilo in Cologne, he had awoken the next morning in a small town between Bonn and Cologne without knowing in detail how that had happened. He then called the then government chief inspector, Wagner, from the Food, Agriculture, and Forestry Ministry and asked him to pick him up in his private car and bring him to Bonn. Wagner did that. Wagner did not know the exact details. Parentheses, R.A. Wagner confirmed Melz's information when he called. He picked up Melz in his car in Udorf in February 1957 and brought him to Bonn. Melz was very drunk and otherwise quite disheveled. For example, he was missing a wristwatch that had apparently been taken away from him by force. And Melz only told him at the time that he had gone to Cologne with Professor Traub and spent the last night there. And Wagner claims that Melz understood it that way, as if he had somehow been abandoned by Professor Traub. Melz pointed out that his abnormal sexual perversions were the real motive for his behavior, which he was accused of in the process. After all, it had gone so far that he had to please himself at the sight of a beautiful woman on the street. The prosecutor asked Melz whether he had an intimate relations with a female. Employees. Melz initially denied this. At the request of the public prosecutor, Melz finally admitted that he had had sexual intercourse with employee Betzel on the occasion of a trip to Hamburg that he undertook. In response to questions from the public prosecutor, Melz said that although he had used Miss Betzel normally, quote, unquote, he was not satisfied. The prosecutor indicated that he did not believe this was a case of abnormal perversion for Melz. When the public prosecutor reiterated, Melz admitted that he had maintained a constant love affair with Miss Betzel. Prosecutor, quote, didn't you also bother the employee, Thea Hahn? Melz said, I don't remember that. According to Hahn's testimony from the public prosecutor's proceedings, quote, if she says so, it's probably had been so, unquote. Melz also admits at the request of the public prosecutor that he had molested Weiss's wife in her and his own apartment. Melz only disputes Ms. Weiss's testimony in the preliminary proceedings that he was very drunk. Melz says, quote, I was often so drunk that I was unfit for service, unquote. Quote, I also have a strong need to impress others by spending money, unquote. Traub answered questions from the public prosecutor, quote, I never noticed that Melz is perverted or particularly sexually aggressive, unquote. Melz then reminded Traub of an evening spent together in a nightclub at Stuttgart, where Traub is said to have asked him not to behave so strongly toward a blonde lady as they were already causing a commotion. Melz also reminds Traub that they were brought home together in a heavily drunk state in the motor vehicle. Traub does not deny either incident. Melz also answered the question from the defender of Traub whether Lilo ever existed. Quote, he also corresponded with her. The money that he had misappropriated was no longer available. I'm aware that Professor Traub is also liable for the damage caused, unquote. Traub says to Melz, quote, I didn't deserve that from you, unquote. In the end, Traub and Melz were both charged and convicted of several offenses, with Melz bearing the most serious offenses, while Traub's were of lesser consequence. And I'm not going to read all the details that are printed here of the charges. I'll just conclude. When the investigations and proceedings were concluded, Traub made out with hefty fines and a suspended sentence of nearly 2.5 months. The embezzlement investigations contained travel logbooks from the Institute for trips taken, which indicate that Traub took several trips that deserve closer scrutiny, especially trips taken by his colleagues sent to East Germany directly for Traub. Werner Schaefer, along with Dr. Otto Armbruster, as we have mentioned, traveled to Berlin, East Germany in May of 1953 to visit the Siemens and Halske plant. It is interesting to consider how they were able to travel freely between two rival superpowers who were competing for German scientists, given the sensitive positions of such scientists between the relations and Cold War developments in East and West Germany. Dr. Armbruster is repeatedly brought up in the investigations as having a clique against Dr. Traub, and Traub alleges they were working against him. Eric Traub also took a trip to London in 1957 for the opening of an institute run by Dr. Ian Galloway, mentioned by Traub in the testimony from employees Otto Weiss and Emil Geis, testifying to the Federal Audit Office that Traub had been giving away free material to Galloway. Traub explained that virus strains were being given to him by Dr. Galloway. Apparently, Traub brought him expensive pens as a gift in return for several virus strains. Dr. Galloway had been involved in the setup of the Colombian FMD lab in Bogota for the FAO, maintaining it until Traub took it over from March 1951 to December 1952. There was also mentioned in the investigation a trip Traub took to Venezuela, though it was not shown in the logbook. It's also interesting to note that in the early days of Traub's return, using temporary rooms for laboratory work at the Max Planck Institute, there were outbreaks with Newcastle disease virus in the nearby chickens as Traub resumed work, described in the investigations. Quote, if Ms. Hahn is accused by the Institute management of having attempted to violate the epidemiological regulations, then one must ask oneself whether Professor Traub is not also bound by the same law because he was in the early days of the Federal Research Institute responsible for the fact that the chicken plague with which he was working broke out in the poultry stock owned by Master Baker Merkel. The laboratory, a converted bakery shop, was not shielded from the eyes at all, partly because the prescribed shutoff measures in the event of a risk of an epidemic were not taken. The outbreak of the chicken plague in the poultry population of the laboratory landlord, Merkel, was evidently the fault of Professor Traub, as the responsible laboratory manager has been hushed up until today. It's also worth mentioning that several employees of Traub, a Miss Sauter and a Miss Wehmeyer, became ill working with some of these highly infectious agents Traub had been altering, while another passed out from exposure to gases. Quote, Miss Sauter and Miss Wehmeyer were in the temporary laboratory of the Federal Institute. Employed there, she contracted a serious illness that made a long stay in the Tübingen clinic necessary. Accordingly, Dr. Wehmeyer has become infected doing unfamiliar laboratory work. However, Professor Traub understandably rejected this reason. He resigned her employment while she was ill. In the first laboratories, it also happened that the first technical assistant, Miss Hilmer, had to pass out several times from escaping gas before remedial measures were taken. From 1955 to 1961, Traub would devote many years of further study to the mosquito-borne arbovirus, Eastern Equine Encephalomyelitis, or EEE. He published an entire series on the virus, totaling 8 publications under the title, quote, On the Immunity of the White Mouse to the EEE Virus, unquote, with additional papers like those mentioned regarding mites and cannibalism, thermoresistant strains, among others. In between this, he also devoted time to foot and mouth disease virus, with emphasis on increasing its neurotropic qualities and its immunosuppressive qualities. Traub's stealth weapons on American shores. As Traub had been able to pack up from American service and reestablish himself back in Germany at the Tübingen Institute, his germ weapons would not leave as easily. Like the outbreaks of Newcastle disease virus that followed in Traub's footsteps elsewhere, outbreaks began to plague the American continent. Notable outbreaks come to mind after his second run on American shores, such as vesicular stomatitis virus, which would begin to cause outbreaks in laboratory and USDA staff who were not sufficiently skilled to handle Traub's new pathogens. weaponized ticks, Lyme disease, and co-infections. We have already covered in earlier chapters how Traub weaponized Lyme disease and weaponized ticks with additional blood parasites and rickettsia to produce the highly immunosuppressive effects and immune tolerance. There is also evidence that Leptospira spirochete was included in these ticks and were isolated from the bullseye rash in early Lyme patients. Inzel Reams had been working with Leptospira spirochetes, and Traub had learned of these combined infections such as Bartonella, Babesia, and spirochetes in 1939 with Carl Beller when Beller published a chapter on the nature of these diseases. And with that, we will wrap it up for now. Thank you for joining me, and thank you to A.W. Finnegan for his excellent work and for allowing me to present it here. I'm John O'Loughlin, and I hope you will continue to join me on McDuff Lives Podcast.